Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present Scott Ritter, a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 through 1998, who discusses his belief that the Bush administration is now planning a military strike against the nation of Iran. A report on protests against the Mexican government's deadly assault on striking teachers and their supporters in Oaxaca. And Barbara Arnwine of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who examines tactics being used in minority communities to suppress voter participation and measures being taken to protect every citizen's right to vote in the November 7th election. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that largely upheld the Texas redistricting map, stage managed by former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Democrats are looking to pick up state legislative seats with an eye toward doing their own redistricting. The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee is backing legislative candidates in selected states to raise funds, train staff, and work on logistics. In Michigan, Democrats hope to gain six state Senate seats to win a majority for the first time in 20 years. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, GOP control over the legislature and the redistricting process has given the GOP a 9-6 seat margin in Congress, even though Democrats have carried the blue-collar state in recent presidential elections. In four key swing states, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, Al Gore won 51% of the vote in 2000, yet Democrats control only 22 of 77 congressional seats in these states. Starting in the late 1970s, GOP strategists focused on state races and redistricting. They started out with 158 House seats and slowly used redistricting and the Voting Rights Act to build a majority in 1994. Even in blue states like California, Democrats have not used redistricting to their full advantage. The last redistricting plan controlled by Democrats in the state legislature packed more GOP voters into the district of incumbent Republican Congressman Richard Pombo, a powerful foe of environmentalists. This fall, Pombo, with ties to Jack Abramoff, is suddenly vulnerable, but his district leans toward the GOP thanks to Democrats more keen on incumbency protection than picking up additional congressional seats. A big win for Democrats in the 2006 congressional election could be bad news for drug companies. Key allies of the pharmaceutical industry are in big trouble, such as Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum and Connecticut Congresswoman Nancy Johnson. Santorum, the conservative senator, has received over $450,000 in campaign donations from drug makers, in part for his sponsorship of the Bush Medicare Drug Benefit Plan. Santorum's foe, Democrat Bob Casey, who has a 15-point lead in the Pennsylvania Senate race, blasts the drug benefit as a giveaway to Big Pharma. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Nancy Johnson, a 12-term Connecticut Republican, received $172,000 from drug companies for her 2006 campaign and is trailing in recent polls. Johnson has also received $235,000 from insurance companies, $186,000 from hospitals and nursing homes, and $142,000 from health maintenance organizations. If Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi becomes Speaker of the House, she has promised to rewrite the Medicare drug law to allow the federal government to negotiate prices with big drug makers. Democrats have also promised to lift the ban on imported pharmaceutical drugs from countries like Canada. California's Proposition 87, the Clean Alternative Energy Tax, to fund new renewable energy technology, is breaking campaign spending records. So far, over $100 million have gone into TV ads funded by a Hollywood mogul and big oil companies. The ballot initiative will create an oil extraction tax on crude oil pumped from California wells. The oil tax could generate $485 million a year. Proceeds will be controlled by a state board, which will spend the funds on renewable energy projects. to block Prop 87, big oil companies led by Chevron and ASEA Energy, a partnership between ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell, have donated over $60 million. The Yes side is funded primarily by Stephen Bing, a Hollywood producer who has contributed $47 million. Silicon Valley venture capitalists have also donated millions to the Yes on 87 campaign. Less than 2 weeks before the election, Chevron, the largest oil producer in California, announced a 40% spike in profits. At the same time, the oil giant complained that Prop 87 would cost it $200 million annually. Judy Dugan of the Los Angeles-based Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights called Chevron's objections to Prop 87 rubbish, noting that even with the proposed oil tax, the oil giant will earn a 63% profit on oil pumped from California wells. Presently, California does not have an oil extraction tax, unlike Texas and Alaska, America's top oil-producing regions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
As the Bush administration stepped up pressure at the United Nations to impose sanctions against Iran, the government in Tehran defiantly announced that it had recently doubled their capacity to enrich uranium. The process, employing centrifuges, can either produce nuclear fuel or material for a warhead. Iranian officials have long maintained that their goal is only to generate electricity and reject charges from Washington that they are on a covert path to build nuclear weapons. In recent weeks, there have been several reports speculating that the US was sending Navy ships to the Persian Gulf for a possible pre-election attack on Iran, charges dismissed by the Bush administration. But on October the 29th, a naval training exercise led by the United States got underway off the Iranian coast. The 2 days of exercises involving ships from six nations were organized under the US-led Proliferation Security Initiative, aimed at blocking nuclear proliferation by practicing the interception of ships at sea. Although US Navy Lieutenant Commander Charlie Brown of America's Fifth Fleet said the exercises would not affect shipping in or out of Iran, Iranian officials said they were watching the movements in the Gulf very carefully. Scott Ritter is a former Marine intelligence officer who served as a chief UN weapons inspector in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. During the lead-up to the Iraq War, Ritter challenged President Bush's rationale for the war, maintaining that Saddam Hussein possessed no weapons of mass destruction that threatened the US. Scott Ritter has written a new book titled Target Iran: The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Ritter about his contention that Mr. Bush is now planning to launch a new war against Iran.
You know, when someone says, I believe Iran is developing nuclear weapons, where is that belief formed? Do they have evidence? Do they have a program they can point at and say, look, here, this is an Iranian nuclear weapons program? Or are they simply parroting terminology injected into mainstream discourse by an administration that has an ideological objective of regime change and is using this perception to pursue that? I find when I talk to the vast majority of people, they're just nodding their head and repeating what they're told. They're not. It's not as though they had independent thought process here where they said, hey, I've studied this problem. This is what I think. They say, oh, I heard it on TV. I heard my congressman say it. I heard my senator. I heard the president say it. I heard the Secretary of Defense say it. And if that's the basis of your belief, you don't have a leg to stand on. The overwhelming amount of data available, and believe me, it's available to the general public. The International Atomic Energy Agency inspection reports with all the technical detail are available on the Internet. Anybody can read them. If you read them, if you take a look at the reporting of the General Assembly meetings of the International Atomic Energy Agency, you'll see, A, that at no time do they say there's a nuclear weapons program. In fact, they come out over and over again saying there's no evidence to sustain this. And B, you see the pressure brought on by the United States to make moot these findings. And the easiest way to do that is to say, look, as the president says all the time, there can be no doubt the Iranians are pursuing a nuclear weapons program. You say that, you dismiss debate. And then they say, the onus is not on the inspectors to find the weapons. The onus is on the Iranians to prove that these weapons don't exist. Well, how do you prove a negative? You can't prove a negative.
Scott, I wanted to ask you about the Pentagon plans that have been drawn up for a war with Iran. Many people believe it would begin with an air war, but could possibly devolve into troops on the ground. What can you tell us about the information you've ferreted out about war plans?
There's a belief that if we bomb Iran, if we decapitate their leadership, suppress the military and the state security apparatus, that the Iranian people will rise up and take matters into their own hands, liberating themselves, so to speak. You know, the ideologues, as they did with Iraq, where they promoted the notion of we're going to be greeted with songs of flower, not by a sustained resistance, they're creating the notion that if we bomb, the Iranian people will welcome us bombarding their country and reward our actions by overthrowing their government. The problem with this is that it's just a false premise. At the end of the day, you know, we'll initiate a process that we won't be able to sustain. It'll bring about immediate negative impact on us economically and militarily, and so we will be compelled to up the ante. And whereas we may not have wanted to put boots on the ground, we will have no choice to put boots on the ground. Generally speaking, the thought process is to put a number of divisions up into Azerbaijan and drive down the Caspian Sea coast to threaten Tehran, believing that the Iranian people, seeing the presence of American troops on the ground, will rise up in support of these American troops. But that isn't going to happen either. They're going to rise up to defeat the American invasion. And now we have a situation where we have considerable numbers of American troops trapped in Iran. We don't have any more troops to rely on. We're stretched too thin as it is. Conventional aerial bombardment hasn't broken the will of the Iranians to resist. And now we come to the nightmare scenario of the potential employment of nuclear weapons by the United States. And that's how I see this war going.
Scott Ritter, we have an election coming up November 7th. The control of Congress is at stake. Do you foresee that if the Democrats take control of either or both houses of Congress, that their control of the legislative branch of government could change the outcome here, could change the Bush administration's plans for a military confrontation with Iran?
Realistically speaking, there's very little that separates Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to national security policy, the global war on terror, and the issue of Iran. So don't expect the Democrats to have the suddenly reach down inside their ideological, you know, suitcase and say, aha, we have a way of separating ourselves from the Republicans on the issue of Iran. They don't have that. The only hope is that because this is politics, when the Democrats take over the oversight committees and they call before them a Republican official from a Republican administration, they will ask tough questions, not because they're really concerned about the policy, but because they're trying to score political points. And if the Republicans fail to answer the question properly, the Democrats may ask a follow-up question, something that's been lacking in Republican-dominated hearings. You know, there has been no effective follow-up questioning. Now they ask a follow-up question, and if the Republicans fumble that, now the Democrats may sense political advantage in going after the Republicans for failure to have sound policy. It may not have been their original intent, but it may be the outcome. So that's my hope, is that the Democrats can generate some friction in the policy.
That was Scott Ritter, a former United Nations weapons inspector and author. His book, Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change, is published by Nation Books. Deadly violence in the city of Oaxaca, Mexico, claimed half a dozen lives over the weekend as paramilitaries connected to government forces began an assault to retake the city's central plaza, the Zocalo, from striking teachers and their supporters who had been peacefully occupying the plaza since May. Teachers were demanding a wage increase and financial support for their students' books and meals. Oaxaca is Mexico's second poorest state and the state with the largest indigenous population. Protesters in Oaxaca asked that their supporters rally in front of Mexican consulates around the world to demand the ouster of Oaxaca's governor, Ulises Ruiz, whom they accuse of corruption and of fomenting the violence. They also demanded the removal of all armed forces acting on behalf of the government and that those responsible for the killings be prosecuted. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended a rally of more than 200 people in front of the Mexican consulate in Manhattan on October the 30th. Many of those who participated were friends of Brad Will, the 36-year-old independent journalist from New York City who was killed on October the 27th while documenting the struggle of the teachers and their supporters. The coalition of activists is named APO, the Spanish acronym for the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan People. Melinda Tuhus interviewed Alex Vitale, an officer in the union representing 20,000 faculty and staff professionals at the City University of New York, an affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers. He explains how his union developed solidarity with the striking teachers in Oaxaca.
For about 6 months, we've been trying to support the teacher strike in Oaxaca. We were here at the consulate, in fact, and met with the president of our union, met with the consul general, asking for the federal government to intervene in Oaxaca because obviously the governor, Ruiz, was unable to control the situation, was making it worse. And so they had plenty of notice that the situation was out of control, and they did nothing about it. They waited for an American to get killed to then come in and crush the strike.
And so what are you doing out here today?
Well, still standing in support of the teachers who have yet to have their full set of grievances addressed.
Because one of the grievances was the removal of Ruiz.
Yes, and also because the condition of the school system there is a disaster. Oaxaca is the second poorest state in Mexico, and the school system reflects that disparity of wealth. And the teachers had an agenda that was more than just calling for wage increases. It was calling for a broader reinvestment in the education system and an end to systematic government corruption there. And those problems have still not been addressed. And in addition, I think everyone here is calling for the people responsible for Brad's death and for the death of other strikers to be held accountable, to be brought to justice. And that's clearly going to require federal intervention because the local state government is involved in the violence against the strikers. President of the AFT wrote a letter to President Fox after the violence several months ago calling for the federal government to intervene, and obviously it was ignored.
Have any people from here, from New York, gone down to Oaxaca at any point to support, I mean, even maybe before all the killing started, to support the teachers down there?
Yes, a member of our union was there just at the very beginning of the strike, meeting with teachers from Mexico and Canada who were down there discussing the challenges to public education in a post-NAFTA environment. But also a member of our union from Hunter College, Tammy Gold, who's a filmmaker, was down there during the violence several months ago and has given several talks here in New York since then. In all three, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, NAFTA has heightened or has accelerated the process of structural adjustment, which has meant that there have been fewer resources available for higher education as government resources increasingly go towards tax breaks for corporations and the rich and increased competition for capital. There's no question that the situation in Mexico has gotten much worse since NAFTA, that the agricultural areas in many places have been devastated because now they're having to compete with heavily subsidized corporate agribusiness in the United States, so they can't survive on the prices they can get for crops. So they've been driven into cities where there's high unemployment and housing shortages, etc.
After speaking with Alex Vitale, I interviewed Joan Roney, a close friend of Brad Will. She committed civil disobedience by locking down to the front door of the consulate.
I've locked my neck to the door. And why are you doing that? Because Brad Will was a friend of mine, and I'm here to state that we don't want his death to be used for increased violence, for police violence in Oaxaca. We don't want Vincent Fox and Ruiz, no police violence. Please, that's what I'm saying. So stop using, well, I'm asking the media and I'm asking the governments to stop using Bradwell's death to oppress the people in Oaxaca, and that's what they're doing. They're scapegoating it. So that's why I'm here.
This report was produced by Melinda Tuhus. For more information on the developing situation in Oaxaca and solidarity actions around the world, visit www.indymedia.org or narconews.com. Over the last few election cycles, a pattern of activities has surfaced indicating an organized effort to suppress the voters of African American and Latino citizens who primarily vote Democratic. Since the presidential election debacle of 2000, where manipulation of the voting rolls disenfranchised tens of thousands, there has been growing distrust of the election process and the machinery that records the votes. The shortages of voting machines in critical states such as Ohio in 2004 has added to the doubts of many that their votes will be counted. New registration and ID laws in some states appear to be designed to deliberately reduce voter participation. Problems with electronic voting machines have grown as the use of flawed technology increases. In recent elections, minority communities have seen scams intended to confuse voters about where ballots are cast and on what day. Other dirty tricks include threatening the arrest of voters who come to cast ballots with unpaid parking tickets or phone bills. This year, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, in coalition with the NAACP and People for the American Way Foundation, have organised 500 volunteers to staff a national hotline to assist voters and poll workers with election problems. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Barbara Arnwine, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, who examines the tactics being used to suppress the vote and measures being taken to protect every citizen's right to vote in the November the 7th congressional election.
We are already getting calls from people who are receiving automatic, what we call robocalls, automated calls that say, "Dear Mr. or dear Mrs. So-and-so, you are a great voter. Because you have been such a faithful voter, you do not need to come to the polls on November 7th. All you need to do is call this number and vote." Oh, it's a totally deceptive practice, and it has no other purpose but to make people, to spoil people's ballots and to make sure that people who would otherwise go to the polls and vote will make the mistake of waiting too late or trying to use this telephone number and using it and thinking that they voted. It is totally deceptive. So we're already seeing that or in several places around the country, and that worries us. We've seen it in Pennsylvania, and we're seeing it in other places. We also are very worried about, you know, the resurfacing of the flyers. These flyers usually only happen on election day. That all of a sudden in minority communities, you know, on election day or right before election day, flyers appear to say, you will be arrested if you show at the polls and you have not paid your traffic tickets, your child support, your telephone bill, your rent, your gas bill, all of these kinds of things that are just untrue. We also know that in New Jersey, you know, we saw flyers saying, you know, you're going to be arrested if you look like you're an immigrant. Well, we know this year, we have already seen in Orange County, California, over the mailing of over 10,000 fraudulent letters to voters who were Hispanic, telling them that they were going to be arrested at the polls if they tried to vote because they were newly naturalized citizens. And, of course, you know, any naturalized citizen has the right to vote. So it's that kind of deceptiveness, that kind of, you know, harassment and intimidation of voters that we have to worry about. The good news for me is that even after 2000, we know that in 2004 there were polls and research done that said that a lot of African-American voters in particular were worried that their ballots would not be counted. Yet we know that people still went to the polls, one of the largest African-American turnouts in history. So it is critically important that voters know that the most important thing is to vote, you know, to go out to the polls, be part of the process.
Barbara Arnwine, I wanted to ask you about this. According to a Pew Research poll, African Americans are three times more likely than whites to have little or no confidence that their vote will be accurately counted. And this has created concern that doubts about the machinery of elections will suppress the vote of African Americans, an effect that, of course, benefits Republicans this year. What can you tell us about how your coalition is working to prevent this?
Well, we know that, you know, the combination of incompetence and the combination of outright voter suppression is deadly. And that what is so necessary, the best antidote to this kind of poison is for voters to be vigilant. The change in 06 has to be voter vigilance. It has to be voters being doing everything they can. And when you see a problem, report it. Don't let anybody get away with it. I want to put some people in jail this year. If you see people passing fraudulent information and you know who they are, let us know. Get their license plate numbers. It's just we cannot have a democracy that is undermined by people who will not allow every citizen to freely exercise their franchise.
And Barbara Irwin, just this last question. In the long run, what can be done legislatively and at the local level, the federal level, to make sure that people who try to suppress the vote are harshly dealt with and go to jail, as you just said a moment ago, and that future efforts at vote suppression can be limited?
Senator Barack Obama has introduced into the Senate a bill called the Deceptive Practices Act. And basically what that act will do is criminalize this behavior of using these, you know, robocalls, these automated calls, sending people to the wrong precinct, telling them to vote on the wrong day, or giving people this, you know, number to quote call and vote, which is all fraudulent. What this bill does is it penalizes those people, it criminalizes their behavior, and puts them in jail.
That was Barbara Arnwine, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. To get more information about the work of the Election Protection Coalition or to report election irregularities, call 1-866-OUR-VOTE, toll free, or visit the Coalition's website at www.866ourvote.org. You have been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203 331 9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikatar. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.